Good afternoon, and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe, with a little bit of a cough. Pardon me. Sorry about that. This is Central Coast Voices. Hopefully you've been with us before, and you know that this is a program that really looks at ways to address change or sometimes lack of change in our community and issues that affect us positively and oftentimes, unfortunately, negatively. We really want to address how community decisions affect the ramifications of how we move forward as a society. Our program today is, we title every program, as you probably know, is Standing Strong Against Domestic Violence, and we're going to talk with folks from the organization Indeed Stand Strong, and I'll get into that in a little bit more detail as to who all of our guests are. I want to go over a few things with you first. Remind you that this is a call-in program. You are welcome to be part of the discussion. The phone number is 805-781-3875. That's 781-3875. I sound like a broken record when I say this, but I'll say it again, and I say it every time I'm here. And that is, if you want to call in and be part of the discussion, we encourage you to do that in about the first 40 minutes of the program. When you try and do it in the last 5 or 6 minutes of the program, we generally don't get a chance to really give you the time and the space that you're entitled to be part of the discussion. So I would encourage you to do that. We're today going to talk about domestic violence. It happens everywhere. It happens in the Central Coast, even though a lot of people think, oh, we're in just paradise and the happiest place in the world and everything is just dandy here. It doesn't have boundaries. It doesn't have socioeconomic boundaries. It doesn't have age boundaries. It doesn't have race boundaries. It doesn't really have boundaries that we would think of as, oh, the things that we can dismiss in our society. Basically, approximately 40% of California women will experience some type of physical violence against them from an intimate partner in their lifetime. Last year in San Luis Obispo County, 1,700 people sought relief in some form within our society locally to deal with domestic violence. It takes a community to really address it, and we want you to be part of that community. Today we're meeting with people from Stand Strong, an organization you may not have heard of yet because they are formerly known as the Women's Shelter of San Luis Obispo County, and we'll get into some details as to the evolution of that change and how that came about. With me today are the Executive Director, Kirsten Rambo, the Board President, Robin Mitchell-Hee, and a board member, Cheryl Wilcott, and we're going to discuss what Standing Strong is all about, how they address issues of domestic violence in San Luis Obispo County through advocacy, education, and support. And we want you to be part of that discussion, as I've said, and that is you can give us a call at 781-3875. And Kirsten, I'm going to start with you because you're the Executive Director, this is the organization that you lead, and I want to, before we get too much into the details of where this organization evolved into its current name, because that's a new part of the process, I want to kind of address the question that I think is going to come up often, and that is, in this day and age, which means, bad choice of terms maybe, today, the last 3 months, the last 6 months, we have seen a tremendous amount of news and social activity based around what we would classify as sexual harassment. The boundary between sexual harassment environment and domestic violence is an incredibly gray area, and I think you probably address that all the time. So as much as the things we've heard about recently have not been pleasant to hear about or have to think about in our society, that the reality we look at, but I think we need to keep them connected together because people are asking you more questions, I'm sure. They're asking their family and their friends more questions about things that go on. And do we draw a boundary between domestic violence and sexual harassment?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. And thank you so much for having us on and shining a spotlight on this issue. You're right on that these things are very much connected. It's great that you bring it up because, you know, the conversation has not been publicly as much about domestic violence recently, but we know that these are things that we've seen mostly happen to women, certainly not exclusively, but mostly happen to women, and they're both issues that have everything to do with having power and control over another person. And that's kind of where our analysis begins. We know that in domestic violence, which is also called intimate partner violence, it's really all about power and control. It's about gaining and maintaining power and control over someone that really you're supposed to love. And the difference with sexual harassment, these workplace stories we hear about, is that it's still about power and control. It's just happening in the workplace instead of in the context of an intimate relationship.
A good portion of the history of your organization was, as I understand it, was creating for lack of a better word, a safe house environment,
a
place for people who did not know where to turn to go to right away. Because mm-hmm. in most cases, I would assume most of the clients you deal with are not people who call you and say, I think this is going on in my life. Can I come see you next week?
Right.
People who are saying to you, this is happening. It's happening today. Mm-hmm. It's happening now. Where can I get to in the next 20 minutes?
Right. You know, it's funny you bring that up because we actually get both of those kinds of calls. I mean, I think we're probably more well known for that kind where someone says, I need to get out right now. This is scary. I need to get out right now. And we certainly provide that service. I mean, we do call it a safe house, or sometimes people call it a shelter. And it is emergency shelter, and that's what it's there for. But we also do get plenty of calls from people who say, you know, I've been noticing some things in my relationship, and I'd like to talk to somebody about that and see get a fresh pair of ears on this and see, am I right to think that what's happening to me is wrong, or what's happening to this family, you know, what's going on with the kids? Or, you know, often it's someone calling and saying, my friend is in this relationship and these are the things I'm noticing, or my daughter or my neighbor, and how can I support that person? So really we get both kinds of calls, certainly the urgent ones. And, you know, we have a crisis line that's 24/7, 365, and we're there to answer it whenever somebody calls. But yeah, we get a range of calls.
You brought up an interesting point in the syntax of that last paragraph about my friend or my neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
Do you oftentimes hear from people that they're really saying is me, but I'm afraid to tell you it's me?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Just like with anything that's kind of a sensitive or sort of really personal topic, I think you always kind of get that. But we also genuinely do get lots of calls from a parent or a cousin or a sibling or a friend, because often, you know, they have a little more distance from it and they may notice it first, or they may reach out for help before the person who's directly affected. And there are lots of reasons why the person who's directly affected may be slower to reach out for help. But yeah, often it is the sort of caring loved one or friend or whatever who says, I see this going on and I don't know what to do. Often they've reached out to that person to say, are you okay? And that person is not ready to look at it that way. And they say, like, no, I'm fine. I'm fine. And so they reach out to us saying, okay, what can I do? This seems wrong to me. What can I do?
Yeah. We'll get further into that. We obviously someone took me at my word to say, I'd like you to call early because somebody, Gloria from Arroyo Grande, is already on the phone. Gloria, you're on the air. What do you want to contribute to the conversation?
Well, I want to say that, you know, we focus on women. As when we speak about domestic abuse, we focus on women. But what I also think is that there is a very large percentage of men out there that are abused. And yet, you know, a lot of the men are the main providers in the home. So with that comes, what are people going to think of me? You know, maybe it's not happening to me. They go through denial. So I do think that we need to really let men know that, yes, there is abuse. And abuse doesn't necessarily have to be in the form of punching or hitting somebody. You know, domestic abuse can be emotional abuse, psychological abuse, and I know that a lot of women can be guilty of that. And the other thing is that I think if we are going to tackle domestic abuse, I think we need to start in preschool. We need to start teaching our children about what is proper, a proper way to engage with each other. You know, a lot of children are sexually abused or any sort of abuse as children. And mostly what happens is the perpetrator tends to tell them, you need to be ashamed of it. If you say anything, I'm gonna hurt you. I'm going to hurt your family. But if they learn in school what they most kids consider a safe place, if somebody would tell them, you know what, this is not okay, and if this is happening to you, you need to tell somebody, I think kids, something would, like, you know, trigger in their heads and say, you know what, you can no longer tell me or intimidate me. This is wrong. And I do think that, you know, that's how we're going to tackle this, and that's what we need to start.
Gloria, you bring up a good point, and I'll let my guests talk about it here in a second. So thanks very much for the call.
Yeah, and one more thing I want to say is that when it comes to men, you know, there are no real places where men can go. Like when they go to a shelter, it's mostly for women, and men don't really have a place to go. And yet they also need help. So thank you for taking my call.
Okay, thank you, Gloria. Yeah, I'm sure that's a topic that comes up. I'll throw that out to all three of you. Looking at issues of this is not just gender driven all the time, but it's power driven, as you said, I think, for a lot of situations.
Yeah, absolutely. It is power driven, and that's connected to gender because in our society those two things are connected. And so it is mostly women who experience this, but again, it's not exclusively women, and Gloria is quite right about that. And part of the reason that we changed our name, because we used to be called the Women's Shelter Program, I know we'll talk about that later, but part of the reason we changed our name is because we don't just provide services to women. That's kind of a myth about our organization, and you can see why people thought that because of our name. But we provide services to anyone who needs them, and that includes folks from the LGBTQ community, that includes men, that includes anyone who's in a relationship where they're being hurt or they're afraid. In terms of our safe house, we do accommodate men at our safe house. So that's another myth, the idea that men have nowhere to go. They do, and they can come to us, and if they're a victim of abuse, we'll happily help them. So there's a couple other things that Gloria mentioned around starting early, and that's so true. This issue and the way to solve it has everything to do with how we raise our kids and what we teach kids about healthy relationships, about how to interact with other people, about what they see at home. So I want to say right on to this idea about starting just as early as we possibly can. That's very true. And she also mentioned that it's not just hitting, it's not just punching or slapping, and that's also very true. There are lots of other kinds of violence, including emotional abuse and financial abuse, and we work with survivors on how to overcome all of those things that have happened to them. I think the thing that's important to remember about domestic violence or intimate partner violence, as it's called, is that when you're really in an abusive relationship, it doesn't mean this, you know, one person one time said this mean thing to you, because that is a thing that happens in, you know, in human interaction. It's really if there's a campaign of power and control. If one person in the relationship always has that upper hand and is sort of controlling, it looks different ways, but it can look like they're controlling all the finances. They're controlling who goes where, who does what, who you can talk to. And then the emotional abuse is just part of a component of that. It may or may not ever be physical, but when one person has all the power and the control, that's how you know it's a domestic violence relationship.
Yeah. I want to bring Robin and Cheryl into the discussion also. So to some extent, it may be my thought is for a question for both of you is, how did you get involved in this as board members? Because I don't think a lot of people, if they join boards of nonprofits, just say, oh, let me find the one that may be in our society one of the most difficult topics to address, and I'm just going to jump on the board. So, Robin?
You're looking at me. this is Robin Mitchell-Hee. I'm the president of the board for Stand Strong, and I was a former victim of domestic violence in my first marriage and a proud survivor.
My goodness. Okay, that's a very clear connection to that. So I guess I want to take that. I want to take that in a slightly different direction then. When you look at the organization and you look at who the client seems like it's not a powerful enough word, but I guess clients is what we refer to. Anyway, when you look at the clients that you serve, do you look at and think about some of the patterns that fit with your life? And one of the bigger issues for me as I looked at the information that you folks shared with me about the organization was when we look at things like we look at drug abuse, we look at alcohol abuse, we look at those kinds of abuse in society, there tends to be a generational crossover. If you came from a house where drug abuse was rampant, if you came from a family where there was a lot of alcoholism, there's a tendency for that to carry on to the next generation. And I'm wondering whether or not the issue of dealing with domestic violence has that same carryover.
I think that can be true. I don't think that was my situation. In fact, one of the reasons that's so important to me that we do get into the younger ages to educate warning signs of intimate partner violence is that somehow I made it all the way to my adult life not knowing what the warning signs of domestic violence were. And so they were there, but I didn't recognize them. I didn't know what they were. And so I think what you said is true. That can be a carryover from how you were raised. But I also think the bigger thing is that people need to know what the warning signs are so they, one, don't become a perpetrator, or two, don't become a victim. And that just you just need the knowledge.
I want to get back to that, but we have another caller, and I try not to keep people sitting on hold for too long, so I apologize to Jason in San Luis Obispo. Are you there?
Hello?
Jason, yeah, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to call in because this is a subject that actually touches very close to home for me. I'm actually the former court clerk and family law legal process clerk in San Luis Obispo Superior Court. I used to work for Commissioner Perrone, who was a family law commissioner for a while, and we heard domestic violence cases for numerous years. And so I got to see the clients and the victims and the survivors, as you would say, of domestic violence for close to 8 years. I would see their entire lifespan, for lack of a better term, of the perpetuation of violence in these people's lives. And so I just thought I would come onto the show and kind of interject my experience and feelings on it.
Okay, go ahead, but I need you to be reasonably brief, but thank you.
Okay. I wanted to say I was very glad that you touched upon substance abuse and alcohol abuse, because overwhelmingly that was the perpetuation of most of domestic violence cases. At least 3/4 of all the stories that I heard and read were because of substance and alcohol abuse. And people like Stay Strong, formerly the Women's Shelter, and especially a big shout out to them and other groups, and really the judicial officers of our county are really champions and advocates for trying to stop the perpetuation of domestic violence. Unfortunately, it seems that most people, it starts psychologically, then it gets emotional, then it gets physical, and it's not a one-off. It happens over and over and over again to the same couples.
Okay. Well, you bring up a very good point. And actually, our third guest in the studio is Cheryl Walcott, who is a deputy DA. And she can add some to that discussion. So I'm going to let Cheryl pretty much run with what you've suggested, because you have a very good point there.
Thank you, Jason. You're absolutely correct. So I've been a criminal prosecutor for 21 years. I currently supervise the domestic violence prosecution unit in the San Luis Obispo District Attorney's Office, as well as being a board member on Stand Strong. And what Jason said, substance abuse, drug and alcohol abuse definitely has a tie. We see that over and over again in the criminal cases that we see. that a precursor, a contributor to domestic violence situation is very often substance abuse. Also, on another angle of it, we also frequently see violence in the household during childhood cited by folks who are now going through the criminal system as defendants for a variety of different crimes. We see that when the background information is presented during sentencing, often violence in the household is cited. So this has a huge effect on our community as a whole, and there is that perpetuation, that effect. What children see in the home affects those children for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, that's a very good point, and I appreciate that. One of the things that as this discussion was evolving over the last few minutes, it occurred to me, I was thinking back over a lot of the historical information and the media information I've seen over the last few years. The escalation in some environments where the abuser goes back in a household where they've either been removed or the family is split up. There are murders. There are assaults. What occurred to me is there's also a tendency, I don't know how statistically active this is, the three of you may have a better understanding of that than certainly I would have, that the abuser who is most angry at being removed from the household or having the family broken up because of their abuse tends to not only abuse their significant other, but abuse and, in frankly, in a lot of cases, and it's hard to talk about, kill their children. I don't understand any of it, but I don't understand the concept of if I'm angry and in a power struggle with my partner that I also feel the desire to somehow abuse my children because of it. Is this a retaliatory activity?
It often is, Fred. If you think about if you wanted to control someone, unfortunately, a really effective way to do that is to threaten or harm or hurt their children. It's often the case that someone who wants to get another person to do what they want, if there's a potential threat to the children, it's very likely that that person will do just about anything you want to keep their kids safe or to keep their kids out of harm's way. And so often threats to the kids or negative actions, harm to the kids, is still in the context of, I want to make you, my grown-up partner, feel miserable or scared or unhappy or like I'm the boss, I'm in charge. And often that's where that comes from. A lot of the threats that come to people who are experiencing domestic violence relationships are threats about their kids. I mean, we hear all the time, you know, if you call the police, I'm going to make sure your kids get taken away and you'll never see them again. It's an incredibly powerful deterrent for people to seek justice. And that's just one example, but we see it all the time. And similarly, it's really anyone who the victim cares about. It's most often the kids. It's also pets, a beloved family pet. We see that. There's a link with animal abuse. We see that all the time. It could be that person's parents or their good friend, you know. If you tell anyone what's happening to you, I'm going to come after your parents or I'm going to go after your sister or your brother or whatever.
An extension of that, I think, for a lot of people outside of the environment where it's going on, and you talk about it when we send a questionnaire out to all of you. So when we get the answers to some of our questions, one of them has to do with what people's misconceptions are. Mm-hmm. And then an awful lot of people bring or believe that the victim of domestic abuse brings it on themselves. Mm-hmm. And it's even hard to use those words. But I mean, people on the radio can't see this. I put quotes with my fingers around it because I don't even like to say that expression. Yeah. But that is somehow what a good portion of society perceives to be the case.
Yeah. Well, when you think about it, it's a way that we keep ourselves feeling safer. If we can tell ourselves, oh, that I would never let that happen to me. You know, if you put the responsibility and the blame on the victim, then you can say, well, I'm safe because that was just that person's bad choices, or, you know, whatever we want to say. Oh, some people just like that. It's a much harder reality.
You've actually heard someone say that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, we do presentations and things a lot, so we get a lot of feedback, right? So people say, well, I'm not like, I wouldn't want that. But other people, you know, that's just what they do. And it's, you know, it kind of lets us off the hook in a way, because we feel like, oh, it's just that victim is experiencing that because they must like that, or they must want that, or they brought that on themselves, or there's something pathological about them. Instead of saying, well, let's look at the person who's doing the abusing and what has allowed that abuse to continue. What in our society is saying, hey, it's okay. So
we have a term in our society for a particular piece of clothing, and I will not even use the term on the air, mm-hmm. that makes fun of domestic violence.
Yeah.
And I wonder where the hell that came from.
To me,
okay. I mean, you can use the expression if you want. Yeah. I won't say it.
Yeah, it's like a men's undershirt, right? Yeah. I mean, I think it's well, you're right. It minimizes the problem, right? It's a way that we diminish the issue and don't take it seriously, because that's like joking about it. And it also is a way of saying, I think that that kind of undershirt has a connotation with people who have less money. And it reinforces this idea that, oh, that's a problem of those people. You know, those people, again, in quotes, those people could be anybody who is different from the person doing the talking. It could be people of a different race. It could be people who have less money. And in our culture, we like to think that this problem is one that only happens to, you know, people who are racial minorities, people who don't speak English, people who are poor, all these things. And of course, none of that is true. But again, I think it's a way we kind of make ourselves feel safer. So like, oh, I'm not those people, so it wouldn't happen to me. When in fact, the reality is very different from that. I don't know if you want to speak at all to that myth, Robin.
Right. So that is a bad myth. It does happen to everyone, no matter what their socioeconomic status is. So so my personal story was in a different city, you know, and we were very, I don't even know how to describe it. We were wealthy, well-to-do couple, members of a very exclusive country club, ran around in high society, lots of social events. So when I first started leaving the situation, people didn't believe me. You know, like, how could that be? That doesn't happen. You guys are this power couple. You're very charming. You know, we're friends with you. That's not happening. So I think, you know, it is a myth out there that it does. It happens to everyone. And it's hard. It's hard to leave the situation. It's hard to share that it's happening. And it would really be a great benefit if people understood that it is happening to anyone and they should believe you when you tell them.
I realize this is a very personal story for you, and I want to give you the respect and the space to not have to talk about it any more than you want to, but I've got a couple of what I think are important questions that probably we all need to know about. At what point did you get any sense that this was a factor in your relationship, and how early or how late did that appear? And how did you initially have to address that?
When I looked back, so we were married 12 years. It wasn't until the 10th year that it became physical. And so because I just didn't understand what intimate partner violence was or what the warning signs were, the first 10 years were psychological, emotional, financial, control. And somehow I was manipulated to think that I kept doing something wrong to bring it on.
No, that's okay. That's okay.
After 10 years, it became physical. And then I was like, oh, there's a problem. Like, I finally realized there was a problem. So it just creeps up. And they manipulate you to think that it's your fault and something you did to make it happen. No matter how smart you are, because I'm well-educated, have a great career. I'm super smart, and somehow I fell victim to the manipulations.
As you've moved on with your life since that, I'm assuming that's a relationship you are no longer in.
Right.
Okay. I can't think of better terms. Does that person haunt you? Does that person's need for power still creep up in your life? I don't know if you have any children together or other things that you may still have involvement with. I mean, I don't even know if the fact that we're talking about this on the radio isn't going to somehow then provoke some kind of reaction. Or is that boundary successfully defined now?
So at first it did haunt me. I was stalked for quite a while, a couple years, and had restraining orders, a 5-year restraining order in place that still didn't protect me or the two children we had together. And so we had to move away to a different city, which is why we're here. and that was at the advice of the police in the city I was living in, because the stalking was so bad that he just wouldn't let up. And they said that they thought it would escalate to a murder-suicide. So we left, and unfortunately, in order for him to avoid paying child support, he moved out of the country. So the problem was removed for me having to live in fear. And I was actually relieved when that happened. And then he passed away or died when he was living overseas. So I don't haunt it anymore. And being on this radio show isn't a fear factor. But if that hadn't happened, then yes. These people seem to haunt you for the rest of your life, even when you both have moved on and divorce is final. They just linger and keep trying to control you.
Yeah. In a couple of instances within the news in the last couple of years, there have been murders and murder-suicides based upon relationships that ended at least 2 or 3 years ago. So people, I guess, hold on to a lot of this. And is that a question that comes up for the clients that you're dealing with? Do I need to brace myself for what it's going to be like 5 years from now? Or in the case of Robin, do I need to move away or put enough insulation between myself and I can't think of a better word, the perpetrator, to make that happen?
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing we know is that the most dangerous time for someone in an abusive relationship is when they're leaving, because that signifies to the person who's doing the abusing that they're losing control, which is the thing that they've been working for and maybe enjoying the whole time. And so it's a very scary time when someone is choosing to leave that relationship, even if they're not fully ending it, you know, even if they're just moving out or going to stay at someone else's house or starting the process of a divorce or a separation. We work very, very carefully with our clients to safety plan during that time. But it is true that often when the person who's being abused is taking definitive steps to end the relationship and even is very clear that this relationship is over and has conveyed that through their words and actions and a divorce and moving out and every other thing you could imagine, It is often the case that for the abuser, it's not over, and they're continuing to abuse, and that's why we see so much stalking and things like that. And it can go on for years, and it is more complicated when there are children together, because often that's a real point of connection, you know, shared custody and things like that. And it can be a real danger point, which is why we need to do safety planning around that. And it's a really challenging thing for folks to try and regain their life and their autonomy and their independence and their own sense of security when that is hanging out there. And people do it. The folks that we work with, the clients we work with, are amazing. I mean, the strength that people have, it's incredible. People do it. They get through it. It's really remarkable, and it's a remarkable thing to witness.
I don't know. I guess, Cheryl, I have to apologize. Okay, you probably could have gone all day and told me at the beginning of this that you were a board member of the organization and kept out of the discussion the fact that you're an attorney dealing with this. Because I thought about this and I it's like, how do I pose this question and not make you feel like you're backed into a corner? And I can't think of a better way to do it. So there seems to be very few actual incarcerations that I'm aware of around this type of crime. And if crime's not the right word for it, I'm sorry, it's a crime. And I'm wondering whether or not that is a factor you deal with every day, because some perpetrator basically has this great plan to redeem themselves and work with great anger management programs, and the family will be fine, and everybody's still afraid.
Well, I can say that our office prosecutes about 600 cases of domestic violence per year. So that is cases that we do file. There are, of course, additional cases that come to us that we review. We always evaluate cases whether we have enough evidence and corroboration to prove it in court beyond a reasonable doubt. So there are certainly some cases of domestic violence that is occurring where we certainly believe the victim, but it falls into that window where we may not be able to take that case to court to prosecute for domestic violence. But I think that really helps illustrate the question of, in San Luis Obispo County, if anybody wonders, does that really happen here? It absolutely does. 600 cases a year we're prosecuting. That's a combination of felonies and misdemeanors. There are mandatory terms of probation if somebody is put on probation. Almost always in domestic violence cases, there is some incarceration for a misdemeanor. It could be jail time, but it also could include all the way up to state prison for felonies. And we do, and I think as the caller Jason alluded to before, our judges and our courts take it very seriously, both in terms of issuing restraining orders and considering safety and the seriousness of the offense in the proper sentencing.
And I this may be a tough one, but I can't think of a better way to put it either. Do you feel like you get as many convictions and incarcerations as you want and expect, or is it still an uphill battle when you're dealing with the court system? Because I guess if it is indeed a crime, a defendant has the prerogative to get a jury trial, even in cases like this. So my hunch is a lot of these people, I can't think of a better word. They probably have some pretty good skills in scamming the system with regard to whether or not they're a victim too.
These can be very difficult cases to prosecute because, again, we're looking at what evidence can we bring to court to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. And our court system, for better or for worse, does almost always rely on the victim having to come explain what happened. And I recognize that puts a tremendous burden on a victim who has already gone through something terrible to now come to court and explain what happened. But we do balance in our criminal system the due process rights and our rules of evidence. So they can be very challenging cases to prosecute. One thing I think to discuss here, and Robin's experience I think really helps illustrate it, is the question that people in the community may ask of, why does a domestic violence victim stay in that relationship? Why doesn't that person just leave? And I think Robin spoke to that a little bit, but Kirsten can probably walk through also other factors in the dynamic that will help explain to our community to answer that question when people may be tempted to think, why doesn't that person just leave?
Yeah, that is the question that we get a lot. And again, I would always suggest that it's really the wrong question, and that this is the crime where we put all the blame and the focus on the victim and what they did to cause the crime, whereas we don't ask that when it's theft of a car or any other, a bank robbery. We're not asking that question about how they caused it. But yeah, there are a million reasons that people can't just get up and walk away. A lot of it has to do with the emotional and psychological manipulation that Robin alluded to earlier, where part of this campaign of abuse, and part of the reason it's effective is because you convince the person that you're abusing that it's their fault. And once you've done that successfully, it's you can have a really good kind of lock on this person, and it makes it a lot harder for them to leave. There's always finances as well, and often even in those cases where it's a very wealthy couple, that doesn't mean that the person being abused has any access to any of those finances. And so we see all the time that the client we're working with may come from a very, you know, middle class or even wealthy relationship. But then when they leave, they have nothing. They don't have access to any of that, and they may or not have had access to it while they were in the relationship. They were maybe getting an allowance or being policed at the store. You know, what can you buy? You need to bring receipts home and show me the change. And, you know, you're only allowed to buy these certain things. I mean, we see things like that all the time. So the financial abuse is definitely a piece of it. And the other piece that I think people need to remember is that typically the person who's being abusive is saying, if you leave, I will do these things to you. And at that point, that person has shown themselves to be violent and to be scary and to make good on their threats. And so as you're trying to evaluate, should I leave this relationship, you're thinking, well, let's see, he said he was going to do X, Y, and Z. He's already done all these terrible things to me and or my pets, kids, parents, etc. Why would I think that he's bluffing? I mean, if he says, if you're going to leave, I'm going to kill you, and he's already had his hands around your throat before. I don't mean to get too graphic on your show, but this is what we deal with, you know. Then you're going to really think twice about leaving. And we also live in a culture where often people are not believed, and I think Robin alluded to that as well. You finally get up the courage to share with someone, a friend or whoever, that this is happening to you, and often the reaction is they don't believe you, or they suggest it's your fault, or they just don't know what to say, and so they kind of turn away and just hope you'll talk about something else. And it's a huge deterrent for people seeking help. Those are just some of the reasons that people stay.
Do you have many situations where the person who's worked with your organization to get out of that domestic situation, that household, if you will, still unfortunately decides to go back?
Oh,
and
yeah.
And the cycle just continues.
Oh, all the time. Yeah. I mean, the research tells us that it takes an average of 7 times to leave. So that pull to come back is really powerful, because again, even when you've left, it's, you know, it's not an event really, it's a process of leaving. And so maybe you leave as in you go to stay with a friend or something like that, and you're getting stalked and harassed and threatened so much that it does make your life easier to just go back, And, you know, sometimes it's sort of you know what you're dealing with there, and at that point maybe you've learned how to manage it at least enough to, let's say, keep your children safe. And that may be, you know, very understandably and rightfully your number one priority. And so, you know, like, if I go back and I can keep my kids safe, that's what I'm going to do for now. And so we recognize that, you know, we're not dealing with folks who come to us like, well, I'm ready to leave and that's it, I'm out. And then we're somehow disappointed if that's not the final time they leave. I mean, it really is a process, and we know that. And lots of people that call us or that come to us for counseling or whatever are not at all sure they want to leave. They want the abuse to end. But that doesn't mean they're necessarily ready to end the relationship. And in a lot of cases, people have been in this relationship for years. And they have a lot invested. It's their life. It's, you know, like all of us, you know, our relationships build up our identity, who we are, how we think of ourselves. And so we never want to expect that folks want to leave or diminish the fact that leaving a relationship is a really big deal.
Do you see any situations where abusers actually adequately understand what's going on enough to decide that they also can consider breaking the cycle? I mean, my hunch is it doesn't happen often, but I'm wondering if how that gets addressed. Beyond the, oh, I won't do this again, because we know we can't use the exclamatory words for what that one comes from, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the I won't do this again and I'm so sorry. I mean, that's part of the dynamic, right? Yeah. That's part of how you reel a person back in. And
is that ever true, though, I guess?
not nearly as often as we would like. I mean, I would say it is a real rarity. And, you know, there is someone, I think Jason, the caller, was talking earlier about drugs and alcohol, which are an important piece of this puzzle. But it's often the case that if those are co-occurring with the abuse, the person who's being abused thinks, oh, well, if this other person just gets sober or gets clean, the abuse will stop. And we know that that's usually not the case. You know, the drug abuse may stop, the alcohol abuse may stop, and the violence doesn't stop. So, yeah, I wish I could report to you, oh, it happens all the time that the abuser just, you know, has a
relationship. That wasn't the answer I was expecting, but anyway.
I mean, I think we have – accountability is really important. And that's like Cheryl's job. And that's what, you know, the law enforcement and courts and lots of other systems are set up for. And without that sort of accountability at the community level, abusers don't have a lot of incentive to stop abusing. They're abusing because it works for them. They want the power and control, and it's a good way to get it. But the accountability can't be just through these formal systems of law enforcement and courts and things like that. This is where we all have a role to play, so that if you know something's going on in a relationship, you speak up. Even it's at the level of kind of getting back to your first question, you know, the Me Too and the sexual harassment. I mean, those sort of inappropriate conversations, and, you know, when you're with a group of people and they're making sort of sexist jokes or talking in those kinds of ways that minimize women or minimize violence or whatever, this is where we all have a role to play in creating a culture that says, This doesn't work. This doesn't fly. You know, we think about it. We've done it with other issues. Like, drunk driving used to be okay, right? Drunk driving used to be just a thing you did, and you would joke about it. And we've come a long way as a society in saying that, no, that's not cool. We don't do that anymore. And we can do that with this issue, but it will take all of us.
We danced around it. We didn't talk a whole lot about it, and I know it was important to the three of you to talk about that. So we've got a few minutes left. The rebranding of the organization, so to speak. So you're not officially the Women's Shelter of San Luis Obispo County anymore. You're Stand Strong.
Right.
Where did that come from?
Well,
why, I guess.
I think some folks know that Verdin Marketing does this. You know, free, they donate this free rebrand to a nonprofit every year. And we were fortunate enough to win that contest this year. So we're very grateful to them for that. And we have been hearing for years some confusion about our name. Like I said, we don't just serve women. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, you know, understandably thought that we did. And we don't just provide shelter. I think so many people don't call us because they're like, I don't want to go to a shelter. I don't need to go to a shelter. Like I say, the safe house is there. Emergency shelter is a really important part of what we do, but it's only about 11% of what we do. And we also do counseling. We have a Latina program. We do transitional housing. I mean, we do children's programming. The list just goes. We have a legal project. The list goes on of all the things we do. And people hear women's shelter, and they get a certain idea about what it is we do. And we know, because we'd hear from people, when they finally found their way to our counseling program, they said, I didn't know you guys did this, or... Like I said, a lot of people, they're not ready to leave the relationship. They may never want to leave the relationship. They want to be safe. They want the abuse to stop. But when they hear a women's shelter, they think, oh, these are the folks who are going to provide me a place to flee to, which, again, we do, but it's not all we do. So we just wanted a name that would be more, a little more accurate about what we do, a little more reflective of what we do. So our tagline is support and resources to end domestic violence. And then Stand Strong itself. We chose because, you know, I was talking earlier about the strength of the clients that we serve, the strength of survivors of silence, of violence. We really wanted that reflected in our name. And it really means three things. It means the strength of those survivors, and it means us as an organization standing strong with survivors. And it means we're also asking the community to stand strong with us as we stand strong with these survivors. This is a community effort. And so the name is really meant to invoke all three of those things.
And I have to share one fear with you that I had when I saw your name change. Mm-hmm. And that is, I wonder how many people who may be clients that need to find you mm-hmm. may have trouble finding you with the new name if they're not aware of the change.
Yeah. We had that same fear, actually, because the last name was very descriptive, and it wasn't entirely accurate or current in that way. But the new name, it takes
but
a little
really
more
work.
Really
easy to find when you Google it,
right.
I have to say. Okay.
Well, we worked on that. So I think still, if you Google women's shelter, here it will come up. We really worked on that. And the other way to look at it is that there are people who were kind of being filtered out by the old name who will find us now, I think. Men, LGBT folks, people who want things besides shelter, I think will come find us. And we're doing everything we can to get the word out. It's the same organization. We haven't changed anything we do or how we do it. It's just a new, kind of more updated, more accurate name.
You have a good elevator speech for that already.
Thank you.
We're down to a few minutes, and our regular listeners will know that I try and get out of the way for a few minutes and make sure that my guests get to make sure that everything that they want covered in this topic doesn't get left on the table. And in the interest of not giving the lawyer in the room the last word, Cheryl, I'm going to start with you. What do you want to make sure we take away and don't forget about with regard to both the organization and how we look at this serious issue in our society?
I would like to just echo what Kirsten just said and encourage all of us in this community, to recognize that domestic violence has happened in our community for a long time, and it is happening now. And we would like to just reinvigorate a discussion and an awareness in our community to really reduce domestic violence and its effect, and let everybody know that Stand Strong, as Kirsten succinctly will often put it, same heart, new name. So Stand Strong is there providing that whole variety of services. We want to make sure to get the name out there, but also it's an opportunity for us to just get that discussion going in our community again.
Thank you. Good point. Robin, what do you bring an experience to this table that obviously no one else can bring to the table, and what do you want to make sure we don't forget?
I would love to encourage everyone to educate themselves. A simple Google search of the warning signs of intimate partner violence or domestic violence. Educate yourself and educate the people that are close to you. Educate your children, because you can't go wrong having that knowledge, and the younger the better.
Okay, good. Kirsten, you sort of get the last word. you're good at it. I've already found that out. So
I'm doing a lot of talking. Well, you know, I could talk about this.
That's
all
okay.
Day,
the rest of us are all volunteers. That's how come you get the big bucks. So
The main thing, one of the main things that I would want anyone listening to this broadcast to know is that if you need help from us, or you think you might need help from us, or you know someone who might need help from us, I would say just call us, because we're here. We do have, like I say, this 24/7, 365 crisis line that's completely confidential. And it's our staff, and it's this core of really wonderful volunteers that staff the crisis line. And that number is, can I give the number?
Go ahead, you can.
Okay, it's 781-6400. And we want everyone to know, even if you just have questions or are wondering about something related to this topic, just give us a call. It's what we're here for. It's a crisis and information line. So I want people to know that if they call, no one's going to pressure you to do anything in particular. It's not about that. It's about listening and providing that support. It's not. We don't have an agenda about, well, you should get a restraining order or you should leave. It's not about that. It's sort of about where are you in your life and how can we be helpful. So that's what I really want people to know, is we're here and we're providing these services free of charge and confidentially. The other thing I want folks to know is that if someone ever says to you that they're experiencing this issue, it's really, really important that you believe them. And it's just amazing how often that doesn't happen. Like I mentioned before, you know, I think some of us are, we get kind of, you know, confronted with that. We're like, oh, I don't know what to do. We sort of freeze with, oh, that can't be right. It's really important to just believe that person. And even if you feel like when they shared that with you, you didn't say the right thing in that moment, it's okay. You can always go back to that person later and say, hey, I believe you, and how can I be helpful? Once someone discloses that to you, it's important that you're like us, you're not pushing a certain agenda on them. You got to get out. You got to do this. Guess what? Anyone who's been in an abusive relationship has been told over and over constantly what they need to do and what they can't do. So they don't need one more person saying, you must do this or I need you to do that. They need a listening ear. They need support. And they need someone to say, even if I don't fully understand this, I'm here for you. You can call me, you know, and ask what help they need. Do you need someone to watch your kids for a while just to, like, take the pressure off and give you some room to think or to breathe? Or, you know, it could be – you can support survivors in any number of ways, and it should never be conditional on them doing something that you think they should do because you're not in that relationship. You don't know. I mean, survivors are making calculations all the time about what's going to keep them and their kids safe. So call us if you need help. Believe somebody who discloses to you and – try to offer them just as much unconditional support as you can.
And someone who isn't involved in the relationship but fears that they're witnessing it in their family or their friends or their community, can they call? They can call you too. So, I mean, it's
absolutely
not like they're not ratting out their friends. They're getting information.
Right. It's confidential. It's confidential. Okay. You can just call us and say, this is what I'm seeing. This is what it looks like to me. What do you think? And we'll just share info with you.
And our listenership is from Carpinteria to Salinas. What organizations in Santa Barbara County? What's the Santa Barbara? Your Santa Barbara sister organization is?
Yeah, there's one in Santa Barbara called Domestic Violence Solutions or DV Solutions, and they do similar kind of work to us.
Mm-hmm. And Monterey County?
Monterey, it's at the YWCA where they do it. And here in Slo County, there's also RISE, which is our sister organization that provides domestic violence services in North County.
And RISE also works a lot with issues of sexual harassment also. I guess
they
that's
sure
one
do.
Of their specialties
yeah.
as an organization.
Yeah.
They've been on the program before, and there'll be other opportunities to have that discussion too.
Yep.
Yeah. I thank you very much. Again, what's the phone number?
Our confidential crisis and information line is 781-6400.
Okay. And the official name of the organization that you can now Google and find is?
Yeah. The organization is called Stand Strong, and you can find us at standstrongnow.org.
Okay. Great.
If you want to volunteer, make a donation, get more information, that's where you go.
Okay. Great. Thank you. This has been Central Coast Voices, and I appreciate you all being part of the program today, and I appreciate the community we have with KCBX. We will be on hiatus over the Christmas to New Year's week next week, so Chris Kington will not be here. I'll be back with you the following week. We're going to have some folks from the Women's March of San Luis Obispo County talking about some ongoing projects that they're involved with, and that'll be, I guess that's the 4th of February. We'll be there for that. This is probably 4th of January. Sorry, you're right. Thank you. Anyway, my lawyer told me what the right month was. And this has been Central Coast Voices. I want to thank you all for being part of this. Thank you to my guests today, Kirsten Rambo, Robin Mitchell-Hee, and Cheryl Wolcott. And we appreciate the fact that you've been part of the discussion. You can reach us at 543-2323 or voices@kcbx.org if you want to suggest some other programs and or more information about the projects that we have here. Thanks very much. This has been Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. You all have a Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and Hanukkah's over. I hope you had a good Hanukkah if that's what you celebrate.